I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Greg Campbell. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you very much, Michael. A pleasure to be here.
Well, it's lovely that you're here, and it's lovely that we're only 100 or 200 metres from a rather famous part of Fremantle, currently called Cadogo Outhouse. But back in the day, your mother, Joan Campbell, famed potter in these parts of the world, had a studio there, Greg.
She did, Michael. I think it was the late 1980s. It was very run down, the old kerosene store on Bathurst Beach. I think it was the second structure in the colony. And her work had expanded significantly from working in a tin shed next to our chook house on our quarter acre at Scarborough, and she needed more space. And she had great feeling whenever we came to Fremantle for the culture and the architecture and the innate feeling that she had of something being alive and vibrant, a sense of community, a real community, and she loved that. So she made inquiries, and the Fremantle City Council very kindly offered her a very dilapidated old kerosene store. I think it was $30 a week, providing she could renovate it and get it into better condition. And she was delighted. We weren't so delighted because she dragged us down there every weekend to whitewash with lime the walls and, you know, do all the cleaning. But of course, it was always great to help Mum with her creative endeavours. She was a remarkable woman. I mean, I'm obviously biased. For me, she was a great mother, a great wife of my father, a genuinely spiritual being. Genuinely spiritual. She didn't discriminate against people. She was very empathetic with everyone, very compassionate. I mean, when AIDS struck in WA, she was one of the first to join the committee that was set up to help people who were dying of AIDS. You know, a Christian woman, raised as an Anglican and so on, but she transcended the isms and ologies, because for her, what started as religion became deep spirituality. And as we all know, the spirit of life, the spirit of humanity, transcends all isms and ologies. It's a very real and true thing. So when she arrived at what's now Cadogo Art House, basically for the 10, 12, 15 years that she was there, that beautiful energy was poured into that place. And today we see it continuing on under the management of Joanna Robertson, with exactly the same sort of vibrant energy and something special about
this. There's something special about that spot, yeah. And you can feel your mother there.
Yeah.
Joanna brings, as you said, incredible vibrancy.
Yes.
But Greg, that question of spirituality, that artistic outlook on the world, and we'll talk about this in more detail in a few minutes, seems to have come to fruition in you in this book, Total Reset, realigning with our timeless holistic blueprint for living, which has just been launched. It was launched last night here in Fremantle.
Yes, yes.
As I say, we'll come back to this, but your mother dragged you down from Scarborough to Frio. I mean, there's certain alignments there, but you've been here, there and everywhere before you wrote this book. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was raised in Scarborough when Laidlaw Street was not a sealed road. It was largely bush in those days. The war servicemen had just come back from World War II. Dad had spent 3 years engaged in combat. And a lot of them were given the opportunity to buy quarter acre blocks for £100. And they all received very cheap fixed interest rate home loans. And I think for about £2,000, $4,000, you could build your two or three bedroom brick and tile home. So I was raised like that, opposite the St John of God's Catholic School on Laidlaw Street. So I had a great relationship with the nuns, even though I wasn't Catholic. I loved them and they loved me, and they taught me to play the piano. They gave me free milk every morning at 10:30 when everyone got their free milk. I used to run over and sit with the kids in the classroom and get free milk too. You know, it was wonderful, happy, innocent days. And one day, 3 years of age, I woke up in the morning, ran into the kitchen, dumped in my high tea to have my cornflakes, and I looked up, and opposite me there was this big, pure black man sitting there, mid-50s, with cicatrices, scars across his chest.
And where did he come from?
Yeah, I'd never seen anything like this in my life. This is before television. And I just was sitting there in amazement, looking at him. I remember my jaw dropped, and I was just in awe. What is this? Who is this? You know, and then he smiled, and my whole heart melted. It was just the most beautiful smile. And what had happened was he was an important man in the Midwest, and he'd had a heart attack. And the Department of Native Welfare, who Dad worked for, had flown him down to Royal Perth Hospital for a successful heart operation. And he'd been taken out to the airport, Perth Airport, and missed his flight, and was sitting on the tarmac, not speaking, with a couple of boomerangs. And so no one knew what to do, so they rang the emergency phone number for the Department of Native Welfare, which was our home phone number in Scarborough. So Dad went and got
him. I was going to say, your father rang his mobile, but he didn't even have television, the black telephone
on the line. And so Dad went out that evening and got him. When I woke up in the morning, there was Jupiter sitting there at the kitchen table. And he stayed with us the whole weekend. And we played a lot. He was showing me how to throw a boomerang. We went hunting ducks, so to speak. Not we saw any ducks, but we had fun hunting. And then we came down to Fremantle, to Cicerello's, to have fish and chips. And I remember on the journey at one point, his eyes were all glazed over. And suddenly he turned and looked at me, and I were wide open, and something went into me. It was, I don't know what happened to this day, and I don't need to know. And there appeared to be no consequences of that. My life just went on happily. I went to Scarborough Primary School, then I went to Hale School, thanks to Dad working three jobs, and then went to UWA Law School, which, unlike you, Michael, I didn't complete because something else was at play. And I didn't know what it was until 20 years after meeting Jupiter, I came down to near Margaret River, the Willy-Abrup region, to go surfing for the first time with my good mate Russell and his girlfriend at the time. And 6 o'clock in the morning, I got up and they were still asleep, and I was sitting outside looking at this whole land. And for some reason, I got filled with the dread of being bitten by a snake. No rational reason, because in Scarborough there was lots of snakes. We used to play in the sand dunes, in the swamps. They were our mates. There were never any problems with the snakes, nor with the frogs or the tadpoles or anything else. And suddenly a snake appeared out of the reeds, about 5 metres long, black, diameter, girth the size of one's leg, and shot in about a nanosecond, covered 20 metres away from ground and bit me on the right foot. And I looked down at the fang marks, and it shot back into the reeds just as quickly as it appeared. It was rationally impossible to have covered that ground, but nevertheless I saw it and I felt its bite, and then I felt the venom rising up my leg. And I thought, oh my God, you know, you've got no hope here, my boy. You've got no phones here. There's no medical here. The car was bogged up on top an hour away. And you've probably got about an hour to live. No point waking up Russell and Shell, because you just traumatise them. What are they going to do? They can't do anything. It'd be 3 or 4 hours before they could get help, come back, you'd be gone. So rationally I thought, well, I need to find where I want to die.
I'm at 20, serious stuff.
Oh, serious stuff, and I'm 23, I think, at that point. So I think, well, I love the Indian Ocean. I'll see if I can make it to the beach. Right, and yeah, 10 minutes over the sandhills, I arrive at the beach, I sit down cross-legged, and a couple of minutes later, I die. That is to say, the beach is no longer there, nothing's there, it's black, everything's black, I'm gone. And then, just like that, I'm an old man, maybe about 500 years ago, and I'm in the last half hour of dying. I'm experiencing it, not looking at it, it's actually happening. So I go through this process of dying. No one around. I'm in a very primitive dwelling, on the floor, writhing in agony, and I die. So it was exhausting. And the moment I die, I'm on the beach, eyes open, there's no one around. I'm thinking, am I dead? What am I doing here? What's going on here? Is this, you know, what is this about? But thank God that's over. Well, that was a mistake to think that, because the moment I thought that, all black again, now 450 years ago. Another half hour, last half hour of the life. Experiencing it, dying, and people gathered around crying, and so on and so forth. I like that. When that was over, back on the beach, eyes open. I thought, wow, this must be the death process. Like, I'm not really alive. I'm actually dead, but I think I'm sitting here alive on the beach.
You keep dying.
Keep dying. Six times consecutively until I got to the 1944 and that one, and then I'm back on the beach. Now, a couple of hours have gone by. To say I'm exhausted is a serious understatement.
Mm.
I am completely shattered. I actually think I'm probably dead, but I just seem to be holding on to the illusion of life. So I don't know what's going on. And I just remember crying out, oh, please, you know, no more, you know. And inside me, a voice with no words said, that's fine, but what do you really want? What do you really want? Now, I said,
This is at the tender age of 23.
Yeah.
Your mates would probably say.
And this is like, you know, I'm a man who, I'm a young boy who loves football, cricket, surfing, chess, beautiful women, beer and tequila, Steve's Hotel, all that good stuff, you know, and I'm having a ball. My life is terrific.
Not planning six deaths.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, I'm not a gambling man, I'm not a druggy man, a good upbringing, beautiful parents. So this is like shocking what's happening. I mean, I think maybe I've gone completely mad, or maybe I'm actually dead. I don't know. And my response to that question was, look, the great love of my life is Lisa, a beautiful woman who became my wife of 30 years, who I'd met in Paris some months before, and I was working on getting a visa to bring her out to Australia. And I said, I just want to be with Lisa.
No.
You know, in the end of the day, love is extraordinary. The
conquers
power
all.
Of love. Yeah, it really does. And the voice said, yeah, that's fine. You can be with her right now if you wish, but if so, you must die. Oh, I said, please, come on. And then I thought, okay, I've got to really look at this closely. I contemplated that question more closely than I've ever contemplated anything in my life. I looked at it every which way. And in the end, I said, it's okay, I'll live. And the moment I said that, everything flipped. So this whole death experience became the experience of transcendence. And immediately, my sense of self went from being that little 6-foot body sitting cross-legged on the beach with a pair of bathers on and nothing else, with 100 degree day that day, Fahrenheit, 39 centigrade, was 100 metres all around. My whole sense of self, and that happened concurrent with an explosion of extraordinary ecstasy, joy. Wow. And then a few minutes later, another one, and I was a kilometre all around. And it went on and on and on. 33 times, this continual expansion until the whole universe was in view, and not only in spatial terms, but in temporal terms. That's to say, hundreds of millions of years in the past and hundreds of millions of years in the future, and it was all present now, and it was the true self, not the little individualized ego self, something much, much vaster. That wasn't me. It was... There was no difference between the little me and that. There was an enormous expansion. And the bliss at that point was so unbelievable. I mean, it's like take a million... Well, look, take the best climax orgasm one's ever had in their life and multiply it a million times over. And I'm holding it. There was a tiny bit of the little self left, right? And it's holding it. And I cried out, oh, please stop. I can't hold it anymore. Can't hold it. And it stopped right there. and then it slowly inverted, and all the layers that had peeled off came back on one after another in exact reverse order, until there I was, 100 metres all around, looking at this little fella sitting on the beach, and I was laughing.
100 degree day, and you were laughing.
Yes, yeah, and it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm laughing and I'm looking and thinking, there's no way I want to go into that body. That's ridiculous. Why would I want to go all the trials and tribulations of life when I can be in this extraordinary space? This was the eye of the rainbow serpent, as the Aboriginals I came to learn, I didn't understand at the time. I'd been initiated directly on country by that creative power, the universal creative power, which they refer to as a rainbow serpent. In India, Kundalini, in China, the dragon, talking about the same energy field, if you
well,
will.
Well, down there you're in Wurundjeri country, I think.
Yeah, Wurundjeri country.
Yeah, so tell me this. Different people hearing what you just told me would probably ask you a range of different questions.
Mm.
But tell me this. Have you met anybody who's gone through that, let's call it a transformation, that you've just described?
Mm. Yeah, no. Well, two people specifically, or three. But because when that happened, I came back home that evening with my friends to Mosman Park. We had a rented house. Laying on the doorstep on a Monday public holiday, 6th of November 72, was a brown paper package addressed to me. There were no deliveries on public holidays. I don't know where it came from, but it was addressed to me. I opened it and it was a book. And I opened the book and I started reading, and it was an Indian lady asking her spiritual teacher a question. And the question was, she said, "Last night I had a dream, Baba, and in the dream I was bitten by a snake. What does it mean?" This is a true story. And I looked at Russell and I said, "Russell, I've got to go to India." Now, I never thought about going to India at all. I wasn't into the hippie thing. He thought, "Oh, you silly man, you know, what are you talking about?" Yeah. But anyway.
Your destiny was there.
Yeah.
Now, some people are going to be more open to the experience you've described than others. And you will have reflected on this. How much do you think your parents' attitudes to life have assisted you to be open to the
experience? Fantastic, to an extraordinary degree, because they were loving parents. They were not judgmental parents. They were very supportive in a wise way of my growth and development. So they gave me a lot of self-esteem and self-confidence and sense of self-worth and self-belief. And they had great respect for other people and taught me the meaning of respect. So that gave me solid ground to be able to be bold or to experience something very different or unusual and not be thrown by it, but be able to take it on board and open up as a result to something much larger. So I credit my parents greatly to the fact that I was able to go on the journey that I then went on.
One of the things I suppose most of us are challenged by as we go through life is deciding how open we can be with life, with others, how nervous we are about taking on a challenge like you've described. You talked about law school. Some people went through and then they found themselves becoming young lawyers and they were beavering away in their offices doing this and that.
Mm.
But you're about to tell me, I think, that you took Russell's slight mocking and you said, "I'm going to India."
That's it.
And you went to India.
That's it. And I wasn't supposed to do that. I was supposed to finish my law degree and go and work with a good law firm and finish up with a fine property in Dalkeith or Claremont or Pepperham Grove with a good river view and so on and so forth, right? But I had no problems with that in principle, but it wasn't the path that I was supposed to go down because that rainbow serpent had other things in mind. So I went to India. Now India, that particular spiritual teacher was known as a Kundalini master. So Sir John Woodruff, a High Court judge in Calcutta, had written a very authoritative book about 100 years before called The Serpent Power. and it was an academic, high quality description of the Kundalini and how it works, the chakras, you know, which are all very new agey these days and so on. But this was the real deal. This was the original tradition. So this teacher was of that tradition. Numerous idiosyncrasies, but a very powerful spiritual being. Because, as you know, not all spiritual beings are necessarily in every way saintly. And they can be, not necessarily like that. You know, people who are not evolved spiritual beings can be a lot more saintly too. So, but he was a very powerful being, and he had deep knowledge of this other reality. So I learned a lot from him. And mostly by following the traditional ashram tradition. This was a no sex, drugs, rock and roll ashram. So you're up at 2:30 in the morning, you're in bed at 9:30 at night, sleeping on the floor on a straw, little quarter inch straw mattress with a shawl over your toes so that rats didn't nibble your feet. 5 hours of meditation a day, 5 hours of Sanskrit chanting a day, 6-7 hours of hard work out in the fields, whatever. Yeah, 7 days a week, no ice cream, no lollies, no nothing. You were either there, you didn't have to stay there, there was no cost to stay there, if you want to be there, you followed the discipline or you left. It's very simple. And every time I was about to leave in the first 6 months, because it was so hard, for someone who wasn't accustomed to that life at all, I'd have an extraordinary spiritual experience, suddenly you're sitting quiet, still meditation, you start to hear thunder roaring really loud, but it's a blue sky day, there's no thunder anywhere. So what is called nata in the tradition, inner sounds, inner sights, inner sounds, there's all sorts of stuff going on in the other reality which we're normally disconnected from and not accessible. But anyway, this Kundalini was awake in me, that serpent was awake in me, and so it was working on principally getting the ego out of the picture so that its intelligence, which is of the whole system, can start to flow through you, and then the ego can operate as the agent of that, rather than the ego being the dominant feature of one's life which runs the show. So it becomes sublimated to that higher level energy. And I think in all the different paths, spiritual paths, whatever, very much to do with the ego coming under control. I mean, Aboriginal culture, traditional Aboriginal culture, Torres Strait Islander culture, they are not egocentric cultures at all. And there is a lot of effort put into making sure that no one runs with the ego.
Greg, we're into the 70s here. Mm. And there'll be some people who were in the 70s about the time we were who'll have their range of questions. There'll be older people who probably wondered what their kids were up to in the 70s. And there were the younger kids and grandkids of ours, who were so, that's all terribly interesting. What do you think was going on in the 70s that led to young men like you heading off to India? You weren't the only young people from around Perth, Fremantle, who were heading off to India around that time. Yep. What was going on in the world?
Well, it seems the collective consciousness was shifting. Because it wasn't just in Perth, as you well know, it was in Europe and
in
the United States.
Western world.
Definitely in the Western world. And I think the reason that the collective consciousness started to shift for the first time at that point, I believe it's now into a second phase transition, certainly since 2001, probably since COVID came along, there seems to be a whole new collective shift going on. Because probably the Western system had gone too far out of balance. It had lost its, like a spinning top. If it gets wobbly, it can fall over completely. So this was the danger. And I think there was that shift happened just as a natural part of the way our whole holistic system called our world operates.
Was it for you in any sense political? I mean,
no.
One reaction to Western material culture is that it's capitalistic and we need a far left socialist. Yeah. No growth economic system put in place. But at that time, were you just looking for personal growth?
I wasn't looking for personal growth. It just happened that I had no choice, that I had to do this. At first I had the political notion that, this system is really not good for equity and justice and so on. It's really not a good system and it needs to be brought down. But it wasn't very long before I realised, no, that's just a prediction of the mind's, in fact, of the ego's predicting out what's unresolved within. Do you blame someone else for something that, in fact, is coming from you? So I realised pretty early on that overthrowing political systems, violent revolution, those kind of strategies or options are clearly not the way to bring about beneficial change. I mean, I think Mandela definitely saw that in South Africa. I'm sure Martin Luther King and Gandhi, and you know, it goes right back. They're not just those three. There's plenty more who understood the ground of wisdom. So I was already in that, just entering that field. So that very quickly evaporated as options, and there was never any thereafter any interest in the political game. I have as much respect for all the parties as anything else and anyone else. I mean, they're all doing their best. You know, there's not necessarily a lot of wisdom going on there, but there are some fine people there. You know, yeah.
Well, tell me this, you're in India. There's a point at which you have to feed yourself. You need a job. Mm. You have to work.
Mm.
You have to engage.
Mm.
And does that happen?
So that's what happened. I mean, the spiritual teacher there made it very clear that, you know, it's well and good to come here and sit out in a cave, you know, in an ashram monastery, divorced from the world, and evolve, etc. But that's not what it's about. What it's about is understanding the nature of reality, of self and mind and consciousness, awareness, mindfulness, and then going back into the world and applying it and living that integrated way as a reality. Then you make progress. So after a couple of years of that rigorous system, I came back to the West, got married to my wonderful Lisa, and we settled down in Perth. I didn't want to complete my law degree at that point. I knew that wasn't what I was supposed to do. So I just started in the Commonwealth Public Service, assessing claims for unemployment benefit as a clerk class one on $5,700 a year, and a lovely $30 rental, as it then was, in Hawkstone Street, Cottesloe. Can you imagine? $30
no.
a week.
No.
On a quarter acre block, and very quickly in the public service they wanted to promote me because I was doing what is the real yoga, which they would define as skill in action. So performing whatever action you are performing, whether it's washing dishes, whether you're in a serious situation like in a court, for example, a judge, you are very skillful in your action, diligence, focus, you know, empathy, fairness, and all those qualities. So I was assessing claims like that. So they kept promoting me. You know, every 6 months I'd be promoted again, and finally the new boss of the department in Canberra, Patrick Lanigan, who had 3 degrees and was a fine barrister in Sydney, he was a deputy commissioner of taxation. He was a brilliant bureaucrat. He introduced computer systems to the tax office where no one understood computer systems. Malcolm Fraser appointed him head of the department because it was in a mess and he wanted to clean it up and not waste so much money, etc. So Lanigan toured Australia to see if there were any bright young bucks who he could bring into Canberra to help with cultural change. And for whatever reason, he grabbed me and I went to Canberra on double promotion, you know, the family, now 2 children, wife. And Patrick called me up to his office immediately I arrived, late one evening, 6, 7 in the evening. He turned his ninth floor office in the Woden Tower in Canberra into his own apartment. He worked 24/7. He was going to clean up the department. He called me up his office and he said, Greg, he said, you're an interesting fella. He said, tell me everything about your life.
You told him you
so died. So I told him everything, just like I'm telling you now.
Told him you died 6 times.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. All of that I told him. And at the end of that whole 2 hours, 3 hours that we spent, he said, you know, I just had a senior executive go to hospital with a stroke. He's half paralysed. He's cooked. He said, very sad because he was a good man. You know, he's a good man. He says, too much stress, there's too much, people are just too tight here, we've got to loosen them up, you know, and it's inhibiting innovation and creativity. We've got to, is this meditation thing you learn, is that helpful for people? I said, very helpful, Pat. I said, it doesn't have to be attached to any religion at all. It's just the process of becoming still and silent within. It doesn't belong to anyone. You know, we do it when we go to sleep at night, a form of it, in effect, otherwise we can't sleep. So I said, yeah, we can teach it to people, all right, no problem. He said, well, you do that. Learn to manage stress with meditation. Lunchtime, one lunchtime a week, 3 or 4 weeks, that'll be enough. Yeah, I said, that's enough.
Well, he was ahead of his time.
This is the head of the department, right? Mm. This is 1983. Now, 1983, the Ananda Margis, I think, had bombed or been charged with bombing the Hilton Hotel in Sydney. Yeah? So anyone who had anything to do with India or yoga or meditation was either a hippie or a terrorist or a no-hoper.
Mm.
But from Lanigan's point of view, this was a great opportunity not only to help the 900 staff in headquarters, literally help them as human beings to function at a higher level without the stress, but it would facilitate cultural change. He wanted to change the culture of the place, which was very
interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is interesting.
In those same periods, we had a less threatening group, the Hare Krishna, wandering the streets of.
Yeah, you remember? I deal with their bells, ding ding ding, in Fremantle.
And Fremantle.
Yeah, yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So that modernisation, we might call it, bringing mindfulness to the public sector, private sector needs it too, of course. What happened?
Well, I thought it was a disaster for me. I thought my public service career is over. It's not going to last a matter of months here. But, you know, how can you say no when your top man suggests something that is your particular, at that point in my life, my particular field of expertise, if you will? So we went along with that, and there were 60 people in the conference room that he'd set aside for this purpose one Wednesday lunchtime. And at the end of the 1 hour meditation, I asked people, anything happen? People had extraordinary experiences. This is some assistant secretaries as well as typists from the what was in a typing pool. Beautiful experiences, and they were very moved. So the next week, there were like 80 people there. And the next week, there were 100 people. And Lanigan was thrilled because he started to get letters about people's migraines had disappeared and their relationship issue had been finally resolved.
And the tax revenues increased.
Sick leave went down significantly, you know, these sort of things. So he told the other bosses of the five departments in the Woden Valley about this and set up the use of the 300-person room in the main library, the community library. And there were 300 people there every you know, and this went to three lunchtimes a week. You know, I mean, I'm still doing my full-time work, which was I was in charge of national training programs for with self-instructional learning processes and so on. And here, Pat called me up to his office again one day. He said, I just got a letter in from the head of Treasury, John Stone, most powerful bureaucrat in Canberra, is the Secretary of the Treasury. And he said, this is what he says. He read it out to me. And Stone basically said, look, it's come to my attention, this fellow Greg Campbell's doing this scurrilous activity of meditation in your department. We can't have people.
Well, that sounds more like it. Senator
John
Stone
like this,
for National Party.
I suggest you do something about it, and promptly. You know, and, well, Lanigan is a proud Irishman, you know, and he's a smart boy. And he's intent on changing this department for the better. So he said to me, you take a leave, you go and sit in the National Library for a week, you research everything in meditation, you have a two-page paper on my desk next Monday. So I do that, a lot of fun in the National Library, a lot of stuff I discover I knew nothing about in terms of scientific studies of meditation. Yeah. Herbert Benson from Harvard Medical School had done good, excellent work on this. And so I had the paper there, and Pat does his letter, reads it out to me, lambasts Stone, dinosaur attitudes, inability to understand, you know, the requirements of changing cultures, and you know, it's excellent work Greg Campbell's doing, not at all with any religious orientation, you know, there's all these benefits, da-da-da. We never heard from Stone again, and he promoted me. You know, now, it's not really, you know, you look at this, it's just like, what's going on here? I'm looking at it myself saying, what is going on here?
Well, something, and we keep coming back to it, something's been happening in our lifetimes, in our cultural world. And I'm really interested and keen to keep pursuing that. But did you stay in the public sector? What happened next?
Well, Pat and I talked about taking this process into the heart of the public service, the Golden Triangle, the Public Service Board, was a central coordinating agency. So I won a position there, and continued the same lunchtime thing for the senior executives there. Now generals started to come, and intelligence officers, and other senior bureaucrats from, you know, different departments, including the Public Service Board.
Not just to investigate you.
Well, yes, indeed, of course not. Of course not. But that may have been, for some of them, the intent, but very quickly they realised, you know, there were no issues here. On the contrary, this was something of potential value. And one of the generals told Richard Pratt, who, you know, became a well-known billionaire at Melbourne, Visy Holdings, about this, and Richard had decided to challenge for the America's Cup, and he was looking for an edge in all areas. He already had the SAS involved in the physical training side of things. He was looking at sports psychologists on the medal preparation, because high-level sport, that's very important. And he called me down for one weekend to spend a day with him and his wife, Jeannie, and the world champion yachtsman he'd selected part of the team. And I ran them through what this was about, looking at it not from the point of view of stress management and so on, but from the point of view of peak performance, of what sporting people refer to as being in the zone. How do you get in the zone? Like we saw Khawaja batting recently in the first Test Ashes in England. He was in the zone. He knew it was perfect. It was just flowing naturally, beautifully, almost effortless when people are in the zone. So how do you get people into that space? Because when they're in that space, there's no panicking. So when the pressure hits or something snaps or cracks, the people don't. And they're very important. So Richard was, at the end of the day, he said, well, you're coming to Newport, Rhode Island. You know, so I went over there 3-4 months.
So you're out of the public sector?
No. Well, he picked up the phone and he said, Bob, Dick here, this fella Greg Campbell, can you get Sir John Cole to release him 3 or 4 months? He needs to help us out in Newport. He was talking to Bob Hawke. I get back to the Public Service Board. The chairman, Sir William Cole, calls me and says, congratulations. I hear you're on a very worthy course to help this nation to reach to climb. To defeat, you know, the Americans, who no one's ever been able to defeat them and win that cup in 108 years, but we're going to do it, young boy. Off you go.
Secret of weapon.
Yeah, so off I go, you know. And every morning for an hour or so, we take people, the boys, through meditation. I was working with the principles of the art of war.
Right.
Yeah, and yeah, so it went.
In 1991, something happens to you. Between going off to Newport in 1991, what was going on with you?
Well, when I came back from Newport, the corporates in Australia had heard about what had happened and they were intrigued. Everyone wanted, you know, how do we have a highly motivated team? Well, this obviously got to do with the mind, the heart, that stuff, the soft stuff that we don't understand. We don't understand culture. We don't understand how to change the culture of our organisation. So that it matches the vision that we're looking to drive towards, but we need to. You're the one who can help us do that. So CEO of Honeywell Ball, CEO of Telstra, ANZ, these people contact me. I finish up saying, okay, I'm leaving the public service, Lisa. I'm going to go into business. I won't work in business for more than 5 years. I'm not a businessman, but it's something that I have to do. You know, it's like, this is what you're supposed to do. So I went and did it. I had a 20-person consultancy team operating out of Melbourne, Australia and overseas. Rosabeth Moscata, Professor of Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Harvard, hears about it. She's deeply impressed by the way we're approaching cultural change. She comes out to Australia, does work with us, so on. And then the 5 years are up. 1987, I look at my bank account. I said to Lisa, that's enough. Now, you never ever say that's enough until you have the feeling, the true feeling, that's enough.
It was a very Black Friday.
Yeah, I never worked again from that point. And then right there, I realised that everything that had happened, Jupiter, that rainbow serpent, up to this point was leading to something, and it was all preparation for it. The question is, what was it preparation for? And in 1991
is the magic year.
1991, the memory of Jupiter re-emerged. That old man's waiting for you up north. And for my mother, I got three names and went up there to meet those three old traditional great elders of the Aboriginal world. And only one was there at the time was Paddy Rowe. He was sitting on the Pindan, 100 metres from the Kimberley Aboriginal Law and Cultural Centre, making a boomerang under a tree. And the lady there said, yeah, he's over there, I'll take you and introduce you to this old man. He's a very famous old man. I go, oh, hello, hello, who's this fella? Oh, from Perth. Oh, well, you want to sit down here on a chair, or you want to sit on the ground with me like a silly old man? I said, no, I think I'll sit on the ground with you. So that was the beginning of something extraordinary, because every day I sat there with him all day and we chatted. All sorts of people were coming and going, because anyone who wanted to know anything about Aboriginal culture or to do with the land, all that stuff, they came to see the one we always called Lulu. It was an affectionate name, beautiful old man, Lulu. Lulu had been raised in the bush as a proper bushman by his Nagina people. His father was already married before any non-Indigenous people entered the Kimberley. So his father and Lulu, therefore his brothers, were holding the original knowledge that had been passed on intergenerationally for at least 2,400 generations. And Lulu said to me, he turned to me one day and he said, it would be very good, Bubba, if you stay with us and live on country and we work together and we write one book. And I said, well, that's lovely, Lulu's great honour. I said, but I'm not a writer. Oh, he laughed. He said, you will be at the end of this. And I thought he was talking a 3 or 4 year type project. I had no idea it was 31 years.
We can, not so much segue, but hold this up and people listening to us will look at the photographs, not only of you looking wonderfully enthused as we talk, Greg, but also at this book, Total Reset. And as I referred to the subtitle at the outset, realigning with our timeless holistic blueprint for living. This is a weighty tome in every respect. It's 600 or 700 pages long. It's taken you years to write. Tell us what's in it and tell us how you went about producing it.
And that's the question I asked the old man. I said to him, what's the book about? Because I had no intention of writing anything. That's not why I went up there. I went up to sit with a wise being and see what unfolded. Well, there we have the unfolding happening. He said to me, Bubba, the world is in real trouble. He said, it's going to go down unless, and he was talking about all life, not just people. He said, it's going to go down unless we bring back to the surface again the original knowledge that all human beings were carrying wherever they lived on the planet from day one. Now, we know day one's at least 300,000 years ago from caves in bones, etc., in a cave in Morocco. So just people just like us, 300,000 years living on this earth. For at least 290,000 years, there were not wars of conquest and control. There were clan rivalries, the usual payback stuff, but no one ever thought about going and taking someone else's land or imprisoning the people. That didn't exist in consciousness. There was no degradation of the environment, not because they couldn't have if they wanted to, but that wasn't the relationship that was held with the natural world, which was regarded as family. We're part of the family. We're not separate from it. We have, our life actually depends on it. And people, he said, lived in great dignity. They were autonomous beings who were interdependently connected with everything. So the real freedom comes not from being separate from I'm a free being. It's the freedom that exists when you are part of everything and function as an autonomous element. So the whole system is many autonomous elements working together to maintain the existence of the system which enables their existence. So he said, this is what this book's about, bringing to the surface this original knowledge. He said, it's like you're going to be giving, or we're going to be giving people new lenses, new spectacles. When they put on those spectacles and look at the world, then you'll see the real solutions. So he said, that's why the knowledge carried by traditional Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander peoples is so important. It's not important because we need to be respected, we need to be... You know, forget about all that. He said, it's important for all of us for the future. This is the knowledge we can rely on. You know, it's proven. It's not a new theory. This is not something to be discovered. It already exists, and it exists actually in everyone, whether they're black, white, pink, yellow, green. Lulu wasn't remotely interested. He said, everyone's carrying this same inner knowing. We just got to bring it to the surface. And I said, well, I said, you normally do that without books, yeah? He said, no, we never had book. No, we don't need. We have song, dance, we have story, we have ceremony, ritual, motifs, and we have country. And we all together, you know, we pass it on that way. He said, but you fellows have got books. You don't understand this other one. You understand book, or, you know, video, whatever. He said, so we give you fellows the book. So he said, you stay with us, and he said, we're going to give you this knowledge. He said, problem is, we don't want it coming out of a white fella's head. You know, this is not, oh, we'll tell you these things and you go away and write it down. He said, you got to go through this, experience this. Only going to get the knowledge when you can hold it proper, not twisting it, not misunderstanding it, not misusing it. Yeah, when you hold it proper, so we're going to give you this knowledge over time. When you're ready, you get more. When you're ready, you get more. I will walk you here when you're ready for that one. I'll tell you that story and sing you that song. And it went like that.
So over a period of time, during which he eventually passed away as an old man, you started to gain that knowledge.
That's what happened. And it was an intense process. In the early years, it was really challenging. I talked about challenging life in the ashram in India. Was more challenging with the Aboriginal people because they were right on to you instantly if there was any little, you know, ego thing coming to the surface. Oh, I'm someone, or I'm special, or I know and you don't. Any of that stuff had to be completely dissolved because it wouldn't work.
So how did it go about passing on Lulu's cosmology, I suppose, and reducing it to writing in Whitefellas, Guardia way.
Yeah. That's where the rainbow serpent came into play. I mean, when I look at that book myself, it was 700 pages, I don't recognise myself as the writer of that. I look at that and I think, that's amazing. Who wrote that?
Mm.
I mean, Anne Polina last night said, how could one man write that?
Mm.
Well, yeah, one man wrote it in the sense that someone did it, but not really.
Mm.
It's this other energy was what came through all the time. And because this is about the whole system, it had to look at the past, the present, and the future. And that's all in the book. A part one of the book is the past. We used to live like that, where we were fully aligned with the system and part of it. Mm. Then the great split happened, and in Mesopotamia, 5,000 years ago, we became sedentary. And then we had rulers ruled, we had, you know, the whole thing, nation states and then empires, and now global rule, techno-elite global rule emerging. Mm. So same pattern, same system basically, and same outcomes. Degradation of the environment, wars of conquest and control, and people more and more disempowered, more and more dependent, no longer self-sufficient, autonomous beings or communities. All central controlled, and now central control in nation states is evaporating towards the global control. So we look at the past and how we came to the present situation. And in part two, leave all that aside, what are these principles that people always followed on earth? However expressed, whatever the stories, mythologies, rituals, etc., the principles they were following were common. So my job was to understand the commonalities in my own country of its first peoples. So that principally came from what was shared by Lulu and some of the other senior law bosses in the West Kimberley and the Aboriginal people generally in the mob, and a lot of research about the similar things in all the other, many 500 or more, what we called nations these days. They weren't actually nations.
In the First Nation world.
Yeah, because they didn't have centralised hierarchical rule. So they weren't nations in that sense.
No.
But they were, in the fullest sense, complete societies, whole and complete in themselves, with their own law, customs, language, etc. So what were the commonalities? Because those, their laws, for example, very different. Wurundjeri, for example, matriarchal. Up in the Kimberley, patriarchal. This place, the law's done this way, circumcision for boys, that, no circumcision, you know. So it goes like that. There's all sorts of differences, and the stories are very different about the same thing. And the rainbow serpent here, Wangal, Noongar people up there, Yunguru, you know, and somewhere else, completely different, and like that.
In the East Kimberleys, with the Mirrawong person, they have a wonderful expression, Narangani.
There you are.
And the time when the earth was soft.
Yeah.
And an old lady one day, when I was standing there looking across with others at a hill, asked about Narangani. She said, "Do you see that hill now?" She said, "That was formed when the earth was soft. And this big kangaroo creature came along and that's him there now." Just an amazing concept. That idea of the dreaming in Mirabong and Narangani is found in other places, isn't it?
Everywhere, yes. Everywhere. And the stories are different and the meaning is the same.
And when something as fundamental as that comes out from those eons ago, what is it coming from Ulu that is applicable or relevant today for everybody out there? We're now well in excess of 8 million in Mesopotamia. We hadn't even got anywhere near that.
Yeah, I think it's a great question, Michael. And in short, the answer is that the constructs of Aboriginal societies across Australia, Torres Strait Islander, I always meant to say as well, of course, is identical in a number of respects, and those commonalities across the different the settings of their societies are what we need to pay very close attention to. For example, the structuring of society whereby the extended family group of 20 people or so is largely self-sufficient in its own domain, that they live with contiguous extended family groups, typically 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, to form a clan group, which classically is around 150 people, give or take 50 or so. 150 people are living as an autonomous community, self-sufficient within their domain, and contiguous clan groups, maybe 3, 4, 5, 6, together form what we would call the nation. They form the society. So here we are on Whadjuk country. So Whadjuk had numerous clan groups, etc. And that society is completely autonomous. So rule or governance is localized. The Aboriginal people could have easily centralized. No problem at all. But no, the imprint, the blueprint for living of our species on Earth is, if we want to have an enduring world, localized self-governance, regional self-governance, local self-governance, down on the ground, because that's where people live. Who understands better how things should be happening in their world other than the people who live there?
People will want to ask you, no doubt do ask you, the only thing, not the only thing that was split, as you were putting it earlier, of course, was that, but also the atom. And there are people who've possessed nuclear power, they invade other countries, there seems a deep human element elsewhere, beyond the indigenous culture you've talked about, that want to control others. I mean, how do you approach, given the last 5,000 years of history, realising that social organisation that you've described?
Yeah, well, that's a very powerful form of non-life affirming organisation. That is a destructive model of governance. It may benefit people in various material ways, particularly those who have the greatest accumulated capital, because that's the system which is existing at the moment. But in many other ways, as we can plainly see today, it's highly destructive. And I don't mean just of the environment, but of people's hearts and minds. I mean, it's appalling what's happening with the escalating rates of mental health issues and suicides, and crime of domestic violence, child abuse. I mean, these are real markers of things are not right. And it's not that there's a problem with people. People are basically fine. But when you're operating under a system that is not aligned with our species blueprint, then the result will be dysfunctional individuals, people who are not living in a balanced way. They're thrown off their centre by the system itself, who keeps them disempowered and not responsible for their lives, because we are now, you know, whoever is running the atom bomb show or whatever, we're responsible for your life. You run AI because you have a mobile phone, because you're not going to be able to function unless you do. Then we get into that sort of world. Yeah.
You've mentioned part one in Total Reset. Yeah. You've mentioned part two.
Yeah.
It's a part three.
Yeah. And then part three is, I think, really interesting, because that's where, why do we want to know all about Aboriginal culture? Why should we really need to understand it, etc.? Well, the reason is because at the end of part two, we now have our new spectacles. We have a different window through which we can look at reality. Whether we think it's a good window, a bad window, a true window, a not true window, we have a different set of spectacles, the ones that came from the people who are holding the original knowledge. So when I started part three, then I no longer interacted with the Galarabalu people until part three was written. Up till page, whatever it is, 530 of the book, the collaboration with the Galarabalu people was total. I mean, I can't tell you how many times a chapter had to be thrown away and you start again, really deep level. I was just the servant of what was going on. But part three, there's the lenses. So I said, okay, I'll put on those lenses now. And this one fella, who doesn't have a particularly brilliant intellect or all that sort of incredible qualities, is going to look at the world today and the future through these lenses and see what solutions appear. So part three has a whole range of potential pathways to go down in order to create an enduring world where there's much more balance and fairness and equity. From the global level, things that can be done at the global level, doesn't mean global rule at all. Things that move us back to alignment with our blueprint for living, policies in particular that take account of the views of wisdom keepers, need to be included in the global agendas and policy settings. At the national level, we have most extraordinary pathways or trails in Australia called song lines or song cycles, the like of which is not known in any other country, although they exist all over the world. That knowledge has been lost, but not in Australia. And there's tens of thousands of kilometres. They are very powerful places to walk and to be in and to experience. And you can have truly life-transforming experiences in a matter of weeks in these places with the right people. None of them at World Heritage listed, contrary to the Camino Trail in Spain and France and so on. It's a priceless economic asset in terms of the literally billions of dollars it could generate, who's ever involved in the process, and we do nothing about it at all. We don't recognise the jewel that's sitting there. Now, that's just one little thing that pops when you put on those lenses. You start to see, like that. You see the bringing governance down. Like, we have, six states, two territories, basically, drawn by colonial bureaucrats, straight lines and a map, like that, paying no attention whatsoever to our ecosystems, which is the foundation of these countries, our ecosystems. So why are boundaries not aligned with ecosystems? So bioregional governance. So you put on the lens, bioregional, that's interesting. We have 89 bioregions in Australia. Why are we not looking? I mean, you can't do it overnight. It requires constitutional change. That's not easy, But let's, we innovate in the most bold and extraordinary ways in the technological space, but we continue to refuse to do so in the social space. And unless we start moving to innovate boldly and creatively in the social space, we're going to be in deep trouble. So the conversation needs to start now. It could take a whole generation, 20, 25 years before we start to see the possibility of actually changing it. There's no reason why we should not be a nation of 89 bioregional entities. So there's no more state government, no more local government. There's bioregional self-governance. And the coordinating mechanism wouldn't be a central authority. It would be the collaborative, cooperative protocols that are set up between the 89 interdependencies. So we're looking here at how did they operate in Australia to maintain this country free of laws of conquest and control, looking after each other and the environment, and living very rich, dignified lives. Well, one of the elements of the blueprint is basically bioregional self-governance. And so it goes on like that. So part three is putting forward, just when I look at through those lenses, a whole range of possibilities, right down to the level of the individual. My great hope is that many people read the book, get to the end of part two, and then look at the world through those lenses, and they will see things that I cannot see. And there will be wonderful hundreds, maybe thousands of potential ways forward, and of those, it'll become clear, and then the change can start to happen. We are, as the old man would say, walking our dreaming.
Greg, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. Say that in the most genuine way. You've lived an interesting life. You've opened yourself to all experiences, but you've done more than that. You've gone out and sought to understand, and to write a book like this, well done.
Thank you.
What have you got planned, apart from the book tour? What do you think you'd like to be doing? Do you have are you allowed to have plans, or is that too ego-driven? What will you be doing, you think, in 5 or 10 years' time?
My plan is to drop in at New Editions Bookshop in a few minutes and ask them if they'd like to stock the book, and then grab a good roll from the bakery and drive back down to Dunsborough and sit out there in my little property in the bush and say hello to my mates, the kangaroos and the magpies and the trees. That's my plan.
Greg Campbell, has been absolutely delightful talking with you.
Thank you, Michael. Wonderful.